When I mentioned to Ajahn about doing this Dhamma talk, I thought to do offer a few comments on this idea of the four elements, four great elements. So it came up a lot during the retreat. We had discussions and dialogues between the crew and the monks about four elements. Came up several times. So since I've been practicing along the way, going all the way back to some of my very earliest retreats back in the late 90s, when I was still a layman, four elements kind of came up as like a teaching, and so I've been studying it for a while, and I can tell you I had some misconceptions early on, so maybe I can tell you the story about the four elements a little bit. So the four elements, just very briefly, they are earth, water, air, and fire. Those are the names of the four elements in Buddhism. So there's several related concepts that need to be brought in order to understand this. But just to start to sort of lay out the most basic, concrete understanding of the elements, imagine, if you will, that you're sitting out in nature by a lake, surrounded by trees, on a day with a bit of a breeze. And as you're sitting there, all you see is the lake, little waves on the lake, trees maybe blowing in the wind a little bit, the bank around the lake, maybe the sun in the sky. And when you're looking at that scene, it might occur to you that there's movement, and the movement is being created by some sort of force. Because say you don't already know about wind and air molecules and things like that. All you see is like the winds. There's this movement of the tree leaves. Maybe your clothing is rippling a little bit in the wind. And this movement seems to be like some fundamental characteristic of experience. So that movement is called the wind element. And at the time of the Buddha, and also the time of the ancient Greeks that were more or less contemporaries of the Buddha, the idea of movement seemed to be pretty mysterious. The ability to move one's arm up and down or move one's legs seemed to have something in common with the wind causing leaves to flutter on a tree. And so it was imagined that this mysterious force called the wind element caused all movement. So the movement in one's limbs was the wind element moving one's limbs. So think of the wind element not so much as like air molecules, but just movement. And along with that, wind can do things like you can blow air into a balloon. So it can inflate things. It can make things sort of hard or stiff that are otherwise not that way. Also, you'll notice that like as you're sitting there by the lake, there's this water. And if you touch it, it's wet. And it has the ability to flow. If you open a place for water to flow, it'll just go right into it, and it conforms to whatever container that it's poured into. So this quality of flowing, and also if you take some water and you mix it with some loose sand, the sand suddenly becomes moldable. You can make it into a sandcastle. So this quality of flowing into things, taking on their shape, causing loose things to cohere, this is the water element. And then as you're sitting there, you're sitting on like the bank around the lake. It's firm. It's supporting you. And maybe there's little pebbles that are hard. But in your own body, you might notice that there's parts of your body, like your hip bone protruding out of the side of your flank or your belly, just inward from that. They're both firm, but they have different degrees of firmness. So the whole range of really, really hard to really, really soft. These are all characteristic of the earth element. And last but not least, there's the sun in the sky, which is causing maybe you to sweat a little bit. It's causing heat. That's the fire element. So the four elements are elemental in the sense that that's how we, for the most part, experience the physical world. And that's one of the characteristics of the Buddha's Dhamma, is that it's grounded in something which is experiential. It's meant to be directly experienced, seen for oneself. And so the four elements, because they're so foundational to physical experience in the world. They show up in the teaching over and over again. And before I go any further, I also want to tell another illustrating story of the time when we first get acquainted with the four elements. So imagine a little infant, a really young child, 6 months old to 8 months old, something like that, able to sit up and maybe crawl around a little bit, but doesn't have language at all. So she doesn't know anything about earth element, water element, or in terms of those words. And so say one day that her uncle comes and gives her a little rubber ball, and she's never seen a rubber ball before. So her way of familiarizing yourself with the rubber ball, once it's got her attention, is to like grab it. And if you've seen infants, they put it in her mouth, she'll rub it on herself, and she'll play with it on the floor, and eventually she'll figure out that it's rubbery, that it's, and she'll be kind of maybe she'll notice that it's perfectly circular, and no matter how you turn it, it's always perfectly circular. So she'll start to develop a concept of ball. She'll be really intrigued by the fact that when you push it, it rolls and it keeps going. It like picks up motion and just retains that motion, bounces off things and comes back. And so for her, it'll be fun to explore this little rubber ball. And all the things that she learns about rubberiness, motion, texture, firmness, etc., is coming from her actual physical body level interaction with her world. We're not born knowing about the elements, but you could say we're born sort of pre-programmed to be able to pick them up pretty quick. The cognitive psychologists have discovered that pretty much all of language, all the different languages of the world, when you analyze them down to their nouns and their verbs and their clauses, are pretty much concerned with just four things: substance, causation, time, and space. So the way that sentences work are all manipulating those four things. Substance and causation are really the province of the four elements. So the four elements are really kind of closely intertwined with our experience of the world, like a non-analytical way, like a real visceral way, a direct way. Even if I pick up something which is hard like this little ceramic vase, you know it's hard because you've encountered little vases like this before. If I'm going to tap it with my fingernail, you can kind of anticipate what it's going to sound like. So, you know, it sounds hard. It looks hard. It looks like earth element to you. But early on, you didn't know that. Like, this could be made out of sponge rubber, and you have no idea when you're an infant what hardness sounds like. So we actually have an analog in our sensory perception. Like, we think we can hear hardness. We think we can see hardness. We think we can hear motion. We think we can hear a fluidity. And in a way, we can. But our real direct experience of those qualities of earth, air, water, and fire is with the physical body, right? And you come to appreciate hardness is because you feel it with your fingers, or you feel it with your ankles, or you feel it with your legs. You know, you crash into something when you're two, and it's a real direct experience of hardness. Wetness is, you've ever seen children playing like in the bathtub, they're really getting into the wetness of the bathtub, etc. So you learn about these elements with your body, and then mentally you extend them by association to the other sense bases. So you learn to see, like, that car is about to hit that car. Those things are both hard. They're going to make a loud noise when they hit. You know all this without having to think about it because of experience. So the elements are experiential, and that's where they show up in meditation. In the doctrine, the elements are, you could say, an explanatory framework, or a framework by which the Dhamma can be understood. And one of the amazing things about the Dhamma is it has a lot of these frameworks, and they all interact with each other. They form a kind of a coherent whole, which is one of the things that drew me to the Dhamma. It doesn't have internal contradictions much, and it's full of these incredible little holographic-like displays of the same structure at different scales. It's almost like a fractal. So just a quick list of some of these organizing frameworks. So we've all heard of the Four Noble Truths. The Four Noble Truths are the noble truth of suffering, the cause of suffering, the cessation of suffering, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. So the very first noble truth, what is suffering? Birth is suffering, aging is suffering, death is suffering, sorrow, lamentation, pain, grief, and despair are suffering. Association with the dislike to suffering, separation from the liked is suffering. Not to get what one wants is suffering. And then here's the punchline. In brief, the five aggregates of clinging are suffering. So the five aggregates of clinging are like the summary of what is suffering. Well, what are the five aggregates of clinging? Well, the very first aggregate of clinging is called the form aggregate of clinging. There's form, there's feeling, there's perception, there's mental formations, and there's consciousness. And you'll notice that feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness, those are all kind of mental. But the very first one is called form. What is form? Form is the four great elements. So right there in the very first noble truth is the four great elements. They just kind of appear there to be seen. So they're part of the five aggregates. The Buddha's teaching has often been called the teaching on causality or teaching on causality. The idea being that nothing that happens, no event that occurs, is uncaused. Everything has a causal basis, both in the present moment and in the past. So every moment of experience is happening where causes from the past are kind of coming in and ripening in this moment and causing us to experience what we experience. But at the same time, we're interactively involved with the present moment, so we're kind of causing it with our attention, with our intention, with the way that we interact with how things play out. So it's not completely deterministic, and at the same time, it's not completely random. So there's another one of these places where the Dhamma isn't extreme. It doesn't kind of come down on one side or the other, like everything is fate or everything is random. Those are philosophical positions that the Buddha does not take. So the teaching on Kama shows this as well. Coming back to the four elements, the causality teaching is sometimes summarized in the what's called the chain of dependent origination. And there's these 12 links in the chain of dependent origination. And this is an explication in some detail of how existence comes about, and it has the keys in it of how we can bring about the cycle of suffering to end. And about the third link down is this link called Nama Rupa, which stands for name and form. So name and form is another place where the four elements shows up, because name is mental elements or mental qualities, which are feeling, attention, contact, intention, and perception. And then form, of course, is again is the four great elements, so that they show up in dependent origination, they show up in the Four Noble Truths, they show up kind of all over the place, the four elements. The teaching isn't meant to be intellectual. It's meant to be experiential, as I mentioned. So coming back to the experiential aspect of it, there's a couple of nice suttas in the canon where the Buddha is talking to his son Rahula. And in one, he's giving him moral instruction, talking about how you shouldn't lie and you shouldn't do anything that's going to cause harm. And in another one, he's giving the Rahula actual meditation instruction. And he gives him two instructions that involve the four elements. In the first one, he tells Rahula to direct his attention to his own body and regard his own body in terms of the elements. So if you close your eyes and sort of experience your own body, you'll notice that there are like sensations of hardness, sensations of fluidity, sensations of motion, sensations of heat. And you might have an internal perception of things like your bones, the blood flowing through your veins, your viscera, the fluid in your mouth, the fluid in your stomach, whatever these things are, they're going to fall into these four categories of the elements, things which are earth element, things which are water element, things which are wind element, things which are fire element. And the Buddha says to notice the internal elements this way, and then to notice also that these same elements are external. So there's internal elements in one's own body, and there's external elements in that lake that you're sitting next to with the wind and the trees. And he tells Rahula to regard his both internal element, earth element, and external earth element as just earth element. In other words, it's not one's own earth element, it's just earth element. It belongs to nature, it's just a manifestation of physical processes that doesn't belong to anybody. And then he goes through and he gives him the same instruction for the water element, for the fire element, for the air element. And he includes two other elements. And sometimes the four elements gets expanded into a larger set. The two other elements he includes are the space element, which basically is the little cavities and gaps and spaces inside the body, like the little bit of space inside your ear, a little bit of space inside your mouth. That's all space element. Internal space element, external space element is the same. It's just space element. And then he brings in what he calls the consciousness element and has Rahula regard that in a particular way. And what's key to this meditation technique, and actually a key to most meditation techniques, is he's asking Rahula to develop a particular perception. He says, like, look at your body and categorize or classify the things that you see, the things that touch your senses, in terms of the elements. So if you feel firmness, just kind of mentally label that as earth element. If you're aware of your shin bone, mentally label that as earth element. If you're aware of, you know, your breathing, air going in and out, mentally label that as air element. And so, like, you're aware of the saliva in your mouth, water element. Aware of sensations of heat and cold, those are a fire element. And when you systematically do that, you kind of categorize every perception in that way, then you can actually train the mind to see your whole physical existence as just the play of these four elements, rather than my body, my shin, my pain. It's just elements doing what they do. And the elements doing what they do inside your body are no different than the elements doing what they do around the lake. It's just nature doing what it does. And so the mind's grasp on the body as something which is under its control, something which belongs to it, something which is a source of refuge, a source of pleasure, it gets weakened by developing this perception. And so that's why the Buddha gave him that instruction, was to help him see, regard his body in a different way. The ordinary way that we regard our bodies is as a personal possession and something really, really important. And possibly even we regard it as self, like this is me, not just my body, but this is actually who I am. Maybe a picture of your face represents your whole identity. But if you actually develop the perception that it's just earth element, water element, fire element, water, you don't have that grip on it anymore, because it's just elements. It's no different than trees and lakes and clouds in the sky. And that's one kind of meditation involving the elements. Another one that he gives to Rahula is, he says, Rahula, develop your meditation like the earth. In the same way that the earth, when people throw disgusting things on it, like spittle or vomit or anything that falls in the earth doesn't shrink away in revulsion. It doesn't react. In the same way, whatever pleasure or pain, whatever gain or loss touches you, react the way the earth would react. In other words, with equanimity. Just like allow it to just sort of sit as though you're the earth. And allow whatever experiences arise to simply be there, the way that the earth simply allows things to be there. It doesn't react to things. That non-reactive stance of like being the earth element when you're meditating. And then he goes and gives him the same instruction, you know, develop the meditation like the wind element, you know, just like the wind isn't repelled by people, whatever odors are in it. It doesn't care whether there's the odor of jasmine or feces. It moves it anyway. It's not repelled by it. the same sort of thing. So he was trying to he was giving the same instruction for the water. You know, you could throw anything you want to in water, and water doesn't really react. You know, dead animals or flower petals, it doesn't care. It just accepts it. And the same way with space. Whatever happens to appear in space, whether it's a corpse or it's a an ingot of gold, space doesn't have any preference. It doesn't react to it. It just allows it. It makes space for it, you could say. In the same way, he's instructing Rahula to develop that exact sort of equanimity towards whatever appears in his mind, in his experience. And that kind of attitude in meditation leads you to develop a great sense of equanimity and dispassion towards whatever happens. Especially when something shows up in meditation which is painful or unpleasant. Rather than trying to get away from it or trying to change it, you simply witness it. And that's one of the keys to successful meditation, is being able to bear with it, whatever it is. Four Elements also shows up again, you could say, towards the end of the path. Earlier I spoke a little bit about Nama Rupa. Nama Rupa is the interplay between mentality, sometimes it gets translated as mentality and materiality, or name and form. So our minds are constantly aware of various aspects of form. Like, we're constantly aware of, like, here, my body sitting in this room, I'm hearing these sounds. These are all elements of form which are being reflected in mind. But form is sort of both independent of mind and utterly entangled with mind. Mind doesn't exist without form. Like, you don't have moments of consciousness in which there are no objects, or even memories of objects or imaginations of objects. So even when you close your eyes and you're thinking about the past or thinking about the future or fantasizing, it's always in terms of physical things or concepts derived from physical things, narratives of various sorts which have the elements at play. And so you could say that our minds, our ability to think, are derived from our understanding of the elements and our experience with the elements. And our experience with the elements is really only meaningful to talk about insofar as there's a mind that's actually experiencing them. So these are like two halves of a duality. The mentality, which is our ability to think about things, and materiality, which is the things about which we think. And that's all really there is. There's mentality and materiality kind of playing back and forth with each other. There isn't materiality separate from mentality, and there isn't mentality separate, like, sort of as a standalone thing, versus materiality. There's a sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. I'm not really sure where it is. It's one of these suttas where there's a kind of a humorous quality to it. There's a monk who develops this psychic powers, and he has the ability to visit the deva realms. And it occurs to him, he has this question that pops up in his mind. I wonder where it is that the elements, the four great elements, come to an end without any remainder. So he's kind of imagining that maybe there's like some place you can go, or some state that you can arrive at where there aren't any four elements. He said, I wonder who would know the answer. And he thinks, maybe the gods know the answer. So he decides to travel to the nearest deva realm, which for him, I think, is the Tawatingsa heaven, the four great kings. And he asks them if they know where the four great elements come to an end without any remainder. And they go, well, we're not really sure, but, you know, maybe the gods of the 33, they might know. So he goes and he asks them. And they don't know either, but they're pretty sure that the gods of Tawatingsa heaven would know. Sokka's really smart, so he's going to go there, and Sokka doesn't know either, but he sends him up to the Brahma realms. And so he starts working his way up through the Brahma realms, and they keep kicking him upstairs, so to speak. So finally he arrives at the Mahabrahma of the local system, and he shows up in the Mahabrahma's amongst the retinue there, and he says he wants to ask Mahabrahma a question. And, you know, the retinue says, well, you know, when he shows up, he'll for sure be able to answer your question, because he's the great Mahabrahma, he's the creator of all, you know, the master of all. And so Brahma shows up, and, you know, he asks this question, and Brahma kind of blusters. He says, I am the great Mahabrahma. He's kind of, trying to dodge the question by talking about how fantastic he is. And the monk says, yeah, I understand that you're the great Mahabrahma, but I have this question about where the four great elements come to an end without remainder. And so the Mahabrahma kind of takes him aside and says, look, these people think that I'm like this great guy that knows everything. Why don't you just go back where you came from and ask the Buddha, because he's the one who's going to know. Why are you asking me? Right? You're making me look bad. So the monk takes his advice and goes back and he asks the Buddha. And the Buddha says, that question's not rightly formulated. I kind of know what you're getting at, but you've asked it the wrong way. He says, the way to ask this question is to ask, where do earth, water, wind, and fire find no footing, have no ability to manifest? And the answer is, in that consciousness, that non-manifestive consciousness, which is bright and luminous on all sides, there earth, water, wind, and fire no footing find. And what he's referring to, of course, is the state of an arahant who's meditating and is experiencing nibbana, the unconditioned element. The four elements themselves are conditioned. They're constantly in motion. They change from one thing to another. Everything that's being manifested seems to be a combination of them. And you can't actually pin down the elements themselves as like some sort of standalone thing. You can't get like a beaker full of air element. It's just not possible to do. They're qualities of experience. And because they're experiential, they're constantly being affected by what happened before and what happened before that, what happened before that. In other words, causality and the elements are deeply intertwined. We tend to sort of make things into a static concept when we hear about them. We hear about elements. We think they're like a thing, but they're a manifestation of process in our experience. And they're conditioned. It's part of existence that everything is constantly changing. And so the arahant, or someone who's deeply in contact with nibbana, that's where the elements come to an end. And that's actually the point, or one of the aspects of enlightenment, is the ability to know the end of the elements. Up until then, you've got to put up with the elements and everything that goes along with them, which sometimes is pleasant and sometimes unpleasant. Another interesting or key thing that the elements and nama-rupa, mentality and materiality, this gets brought out in some of the suttas, that because that's all that's really happening, the mind is knowing the elements and the elements are informing the mind. Another way of looking at it is that all that ever happens is the five aggregates are being grasped at, sort of like in normal human existence. The mind is always sort of holding onto one or another of the five aggregates. And of course, the main aggregate is the aggregate of form. The key, the exit way to this is to understand that the external world that seems to be a standalone world all by itself, independent of us and us independent of it, in other words, this whole experience of duality, is something to be understood very deeply, is something to be explored. And the only way you can really explore it is to sort of, you could say, like strip away all the presumptions and the mental proliferation that we tend to build up, especially as educated adults, and almost go back to basics, almost go back to be that little girl with a rubber ball and like get right down to what's actually happening. And so that's what meditation's all about. If you develop meditation, somewhere along the way, you'll be confronted with trying to directly know what a sensory contact actually is. Actually is maybe not the right phrase for it, but to try to really know it, to really, really get down to the basics of it. And it's often said, or often shows up in the suttas, that mindfulness directed at the body, which is the classic core vipassana practice, that by itself, without any other of the amazing techniques and meditation practices or psychic powers or anything else, just mindfulness directed at the body can take you all the way to enlightenment. Even just mindfulness of breathing can take you all the way to enlightenment. Mindfulness of breathing is itself you could say, a kind of a four elements meditation. Because if you're actually mindful of breathing, you're aware of the air touching the nostrils, the vibration, the movement, the temperature, the firmness or softness of the breath. Those are all elemental qualities, elemental sensations. And to try to really get the mind to sort of stop conceptualizing about those things and experience it directly is what opens the door to seeing how it is that the mind fabricates the reality in which we live. Once that's seen very deeply, then the idea that it's somehow yours or is a problem or has any of the other characteristics that we usually attribute to it, that becomes less and less tenable. And then all of one's sort of dreams and imaginings about this reality, all of one's passions, you could say, those become less and less compelling. And so when you really deeply see how this all works, how mentality and materiality interact with each other to create our experience, then the illusion of its desirability, of its ability to be a resource or a refuge, of its ability to be possessed or owned or have an identity, all those kind of things that we lay on top of, things which are not elemental, those become no longer very interesting. It's sort of like they lose their color. And when that sense of dispassion towards things arise, there's a real kind of steady equanimity that's able to step back and, you could say, maybe not mentally ask the question, but open the door towards the possibility of a mentality or a moment of experience that doesn't include grasping at some object. The mind is essentially grasping from one object to the next object. It knows this, and then it lets go of that and knows something else, and lets go of that and knows something else. And this knowing of one thing after another is what leads us through our whole day, our whole conscious existence. The ability to stop grasping, even for just one mind moment, is what opens the door to the deathless. But to stop grasping requires the willingness to stop grasping. And at some deep level, we're sure that we have to keep grasping. The only way that you can actually let go of that grasping is to see directly how it works, what it is that you're grasping at, and maybe why, and the true nature of the thing that you're grasping. And so that kind of brings us back to the elements, because that's all that's being grasped. It's the elements and the things that we imagine about the elements. But there's nothing there that to them in a way. Like they don't really exist without the mind that grasps them. So you could say that the four elements are the theme that starts off with us just sort of like looking at the concrete world and takes us all the way to liberation. And it's one of multiple ways that you can approach the Dhamma. So because it shows up so many times, though, I thought it would be worthwhile to give an overview. So I'll leave it at that.